Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. So far this year, Ohio has seen at least 108,000 foreclosures. Now admissions of improperly signed foreclosure documents have caused many banks to slow or suspend the foreclosure process. State and federal officials are launching investigations into so-called robo-signing. That's the process where bank officers just sign foreclosure documents without reading them. Some call it sloppy paperwork. Attorney General Richard Cordray calls it something more.
What we have here is lying under oath. The facts may or may not be correct, and this seems to have been an industry-wide practice where the companies encouraged this and required it of their employees to commit deliberate fraud on the court in case after case after case.
What does this mean for Central Ohio families at risk for foreclosure, and what does it mean for the state and local economy, in particular the Central Ohio housing market? Our question for you this hour, have you lost your home? Are you in danger of losing your home because what you believe is a paperwork error during the foreclosure process? Give us a call at 614-292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joining us is Ohio Poverty Law Center Senior Attorney Linda Cook. Linda, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Mike.
And Ellen Bardeen. She's a counselor with Homes on the Hill. That's a Columbus agency that helps people avoid or deal with foreclosure. Ellen, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
Linda, let's start with you. How many, even a rough estimate, how many robo-signed foreclosures have we seen here in Central Ohio, even a ballpark estimate of how big a problem it is here?
Wow, I'm not sure that I could actually take a guess on that. I know that all of the major lenders, the four major lenders, have had robo-signers identified in depositions that are now in the, you know, pretty much the public domain. How many of those are in Franklin County? I would guess that at least 20% to 30% of the foreclosures that have been filed in court have problems with the affidavits.
Ellen, have you seen in your work helping your clients, have you seen what you suspect might be a robo-signed stack of documents?
No, we haven't. It hasn't been part of our practices to check those documents. We're usually working before it gets to
stage. Okay. There was a dispatch analysis about a week ago, and they found that quite a few in a sheriff's auction were suspect, at least, and probably signed by the robo-signers and things like that. Linda, can you explain what to folks who perhaps aren't as familiar with what this story is all about, what is a robo-signed foreclosure document?
A robo-signed foreclosure document is an affidavit that was signed by someone who did not first review the underlying paperwork that forms the basis of the statements that they are making to the court as truth. If you have not reviewed the documents, then you are telling an untruth by signing a document that you did and that the information in those documents is accurate and complete.
Give us an idea how many documents are included in a standard foreclosure process.
Oh my!
Right there's an answer.
Well, in a closing, and I don't know how many of the people listening have been involved in a real estate closing lately, but you can sign or receive between 60 and 90 pieces of paper. Many of those you need to sign or initial. The closings are done by title companies, by and large, who are not there to explain those documents, but there to have you sign as quickly as possible so they can move on to the next job that they have to do.
So in a foreclosure process, you're seeing a similar size stack of papers. If you're the person who's designated by the bank to approve the foreclosure documents.
Well, the person who's reviewing those documents to swear to the truth of the matter has or should have the entire payment history of that borrower. They need to have the promissory note, the original, preferably, but at least a copy. They need to have the mortgage deed, and they need to have the notices that were sent to the borrower advising them that they were in default and the consequences of default.
Mm-hmm. 292-8513 if you'd like to join us. We're asking if you have faced foreclosure because of a paperwork error, please give us a call, 292-8513. Ellen, what are you telling your clients as they come in?
Well, we ask them to work through the entire process carefully and pay attention to everything that they receive, all the documents. We educate them about the Court of Common Pleas website so that they can read the documents that have been filed for their case. And if they feel that there has been a paperwork error, then we do refer them to an attorney mm-hmm. to help them.
That's what you have stressed throughout this crisis, to contact somebody early. And this is why, because if there's an error in the paperwork, it can be spotted early and something could possibly be done, correct?
Yes, and we see errors happening all the time. There are incorrect records kept about payments and notices that are sent or not sent, or documents that are received by the servicer are lost. So we see this happening continuously in the process.
Mm-hmm. Linda Cook from the Ohio Poverty Law Center, what's the role of the judge in all this?
The role of the judge is to make a decision based on reliable and probative evidence. The problem with the faulty or false or fraudulent affidavits is that those actually do not constitute reliable and probative evidence that gives the judge a good basis on which to make a decision.
So, should the judges be responsible for trying to review these documents as well? If we're asking banks to review all these documents, should the courts be reviewing all these documents as well? Or are they just relying on what the parties are saying?
Well, the courts aren't going to be happy with my answer, but yes, the courts should be reviewing all the documents before they sign a judgment entry granting the lender the right to foreclose on someone's home. The reality is there's, just like the banks are overwhelmed with the number of foreclosures that they have to process, the courts are similarly overwhelmed with the number of complaints for foreclosure being filed. So, you have to make decisions about whether you have the time to review those documents, and then you have a tendency to rely on the parties. And if they've submitted an affidavit saying, yes, I've reviewed these records, and yes, these are accurate, you want to accept that as true. Mm-hmm. Now the information is coming to light that, wow, perhaps it isn't true.
What would this do to the process if everyone had to read, well, should be, as following the law, and reading all these documents, both the bank and the judges, what would it do to the process if this actually was happening, if they're reading all the documents and making sure everything was in order and then signing it and then approving it? Or how much would it delay the process? Any idea?
It would slow down the process substantially. I don't know how many foreclosure entries get signed daily in Franklin County, but it would substantially reduce that number, in my opinion. As a consumer advocate, that's a good thing because we should not quickly want to take somebody out of their house. It seems fair to ask that the process be accurate and complete.
Okay. 292-8513 is our phone number. We're especially interested in hearing from folks who are going through or have gone through the foreclosure process and have questions about this, and perhaps were a victim of the robocalls, if that's the case. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. I think this happened to me at the family home that we've had in our family since 1960. My mother had it, and it was passed down to me in her will and that kind of thing. But my son had it for a minute to handle, and he refinanced some sort of way. My mother had it through, I think, the thing called, I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it's where they give the elderly money on their mortgage. My son took over, and he took it out of that, refinanced with Wells Fargo. And when this happened, all of a sudden, it went into a foreclosure thing with Wells Fargo. I called them and tried to make arrangements to even do a, back catch up on some sort of, I forget what the thing is called, back pay or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they just basically, I got some woman or girl on the phone sounded very young, and she said, no, there's nothing you can do. You have to come up with the full amount. I said, well, is there a short sale, you know, amount that I could possibly pay off or something like that? I have a friend that will be willing to pay that for me, just pay the thing. No, there's nothing you can do with that. You have to call. I mean, it was basically a turned out to every way I went to try to get this settled. And we lost the home. It went into foreclosure and was resold. It was a very nice home. It was put back on the market again and resold. I see it's up for sale again now, so I'm just wondering. But for someone who's lost their home this way, what recourse would we have?
Linda.
Well, that's a very good question that people, the legal system is just beginning to explore what the recourse is. But if the home has already been sold and the time limit for going back and reviewing the judgment and the paperwork has not expired, at this point, your recourse is to sue for money. You're not going to get the house back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else, Michael?
Yes, it would be. You say we could go into court and sue them. That's the other way we could possibly do this, and we could show and prove this happened to us. Then we would have a recourse of suing. Is that correct?
Well, you would need to consult an attorney to have them review your situation and what's happened to you. It's not possible for me to analyze that situation on the air here because I would need a lot of detail. But my advice would be to seek the advice of an attorney, have all of your documents and paperwork, and they can review those and give you some good advice.
Okay. Good luck to you, Michael. Ellen, that's been a complaint. I think this is just another symptom or another aspect of what has been the complaint against the banks throughout this crisis is that there are so many cases of foreclosure out there, pending foreclosure, that either the banks are overwhelmed and do not have the capabilities of answering each homeowner's question, or they don't want to. And this robo-signing method is just a part of that efficiency, the banks might call it.
I would agree with that. They are overwhelmed. They don't have sufficient systems in place to be able to manage the number of homeowners that are contacting them and asking them for assistance. I wouldn't judge them and say that they don't want to help, but it is very difficult to get help. And I agree, it has been an ongoing concern that homeowners continuously call and ask for help and submit documents over and over and over again, and they're not getting the answers that they need.
Okay. 292-8513, if you'd like to share your story about foreclosure. We'll continue our discussion about the latest chapter in the housing crisis that put many foreclosures up in the air. We'll continue on all sides on WOSU 820.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the Federal Reserve weighs in big to support recovery. We'll look at the Fed printing money and what it means for the U.S. economy. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. 45 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. A slight chance of rain today, otherwise partly sunny and a high of 54. A slight chance of rain tonight, mostly cloudy skies, a low of 35 degrees.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating our nationally ranked library, zoo, and science museum. With donors and funds in 33 Ohio counties, the Columbus Foundation, where your philanthropy and your community come together.
All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're talking about the stories of improperly, possibly fraudulently signed foreclosure documents, so-called robo-signing, done on the part of the banks to speed the foreclosure process. some complain that this effort towards efficiency has meant that some people have lost their homes that didn't have to lose their homes. Our guests are Linda Cook from the Ohio Poverty Law Center and Ellen Bardeen, a counselor with Homes on the Hill, a local agency that helps folks deal with the foreclosure process. Linda, Attorney General Richard Cordray, we heard him at the start of the program, calls this fraud. The banks call it sloppy paperwork. Which do you believe it is?
Mike, I believe that it is fraud, and I understand the bank's position that, you know, homeowners borrowed the money, they signed a promise that they would pay, and they are in default on that promise. But the other side of that is if the banks want to hold the homeowners and borrowers to their obligations, then the banks also need to be held to their obligations. We don't have, I hope we don't have a two-tiered system of justice here where the law of contract applies to the homeowners, but the laws of commercial paper and contract do not apply to the lenders. I would not like to think that we have that kind of a system.
Now, the argument is that, yes, they were signed en masse, signed without reading all the documents, but the bottom line is the people who were foreclosed upon in many cases were not paying their mortgage for whatever reason, loss of job, balloon mortgage, whatever. They just were not fulfilling their obligations to the lender, and they lost their home as they should have. What's your response to that?
Well, you're correct, Mike, that many people have defaulted for one reason or another. But that doesn't change the fact that our system of justice says that before you can foreclose and take that property back, you have to jump through these hoops. And the problem is that the lenders, the lending industry, created systems to move massive amounts of money and lend massive amounts of money without regard for the other end of that. As you know, we need to have the safeguards in place to make sure that all of the pieces of those lending transactions come back together correctly. So when it doesn't work out, we have the information, we know it's correct, and we can show that we have the right to foreclose.
Ellen Bardeen from Homes on the Hill, the thing I've heard that housing advocates are advising their clients to ask is, where is the note? Are you telling your clients that when they call? What does that mean?
Would you suggest that they ask the loan servicer to demonstrate that they have the note in their possession?
The note is?
The promissory note is the agreement between the buyer and the lender to make the payment to the lender. Mm-hmm. And the lender should have possession of that in order to show that they have the right to foreclose.
So that's the bottom line. The person who is foreclosing on the homeowner has to be the person who's owed the money. That's
right.
Basically what you're making them prove.
Yes.
And why is – it seems like that's pretty simple. You know, I'm getting a foreclosure notice. It's coming from the person I owe the money. But it's not always so simple, right, Ellen?
No. The lenders may not have the promissory note in their possession because oftentimes the transactions that take place to transfer servicing of a loan or ownership of a loan is transferred electronically, not on paper, so there are not necessarily the passing of these documents on paper to the next owner or holder of the loan.
How much, either of you can weigh in, how much has the whole bundling and rebundling, splitting up these mortgages, how much has that led to confusion over where the note lies?
Oh, that's the principal reason that there's confusion. You know, mortgage securitization was good in the sense that it freed a lot of capital and put money in the system to enable, you know, more lending, and some of that was a good thing. There were problems with underwriting and perhaps too much careless lending going on, but, you know, that fragmented all those pieces of paper, and now, you know, that when they have to come back together in one location to foreclose, it's made it extremely difficult to produce those.
Okay. 292-8513, if you'd like to join in our discussion. Let's go to Matt. You're on the air. Go ahead, Matt.
Yes, your discussion was getting at the question that I have. If somebody wants to renegotiate the terms of a loan that is so badly fragmented that one cannot tell where the ownership lies. I imagine that that would suppress the negotiated settlement as opposed to the foreclosure process, too.
Well, Matt, yes, you've pointed out another issue that kind of people don't really want to think about too much, but lawyers who negotiate on behalf of homeowners are thinking, wait a minute, are you the right person that I should be negotiating with? And yes, robo-signers have created this insecurity and make people very uncomfortable about even negotiating settlements.
Anything else, Matt?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. 292-8513 if you'd like to join in our discussion. So this really began back even in the 70s when, you know, the more electronic stuff came in and the mortgages became – banks look for further – more and more efficiency to try to process these loans faster. I'm thinking about the electronic company down in Virginia that the Washington Post reported on that, you know, sped this process along. To buy a house, it was became much – easier for the banks, even easier for the consumers, and now foreclosing is just a continuation of that process.
Yeah, Mike, what you're talking about, there are two big electronic systems that the mortgage industry has taken have created and then taken advantage of. One is MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, and the other one is LPS and DocX, which are this the loan processing services, and DocX is a subsidiary of that. So MERS collects and stores documents and acts as the nominee for land title registration purposes, and that avoids the constant need to record reassignments of a mortgage, so you can buy and sell and buy and sell and buy and sell without paying the, you know, recording fees every time a mortgage is assigned, which then, of course, cuts the county out of revenues.
Yeah. You can save the homeowner money, too, in theory.
In theory, yes. And then, you know, the LPS, which helps the servicers and the lenders track transactions and keep them on a foreclosure schedule and a lot of other services, some of which are, mm-hmm. if you look at their price list, are a little suspect.
Okay. Ellen, what's the solution here? I mean, is there a solution? Or do we just have to work our way through this?
I think we're going to have to work our way through it. I am pleased that more issues are coming out about the servicers. I think it started with awareness on the part of the government and the country as a whole about the issues that the servicers were having with managing paperwork and getting responses to the homeowners. And now this is one more issue that's come out that is another signal that they're not capable of doing their job well. And I think we're going to have to take one more step towards encouraging them to do it right.
In the meantime, does it hurt folks who even aren't involved in this, who are making their payments and maybe just want to sell their home, so that it just extends the sort of glut of foreclosed properties on the market, and it's going to take longer to get through this, and it could hurt the overall local real estate market?
Yes, as homes are foreclosed in a neighborhood, it does affect the property values of that neighborhood, so it makes it more difficult for a homeowner that's been making their payments to sell their home at a reasonable price and make a profit on it.
Mm-hmm. But, Linda, your argument is that speed should not be our driving force here. It should be fairness and making sure that everything is done correctly.
Yes, I understand that the banks want to say that a non-paying borrower should be out and transitioned into a more affordable situation for them and allow that home to get back on the market and to get into a new owner who can pay. But, you know, there's already a glut of REO properties on the market that the latest things that I've read indicate that it would take a minimum of 3 years to clear the current inventory. So I'm not sure that we need to be in a real rush to put even more properties on the market. I think we need to pause now and sort out the problem, so when properties are on the market, people can be assured that they have clear title to those, that they were properly foreclosed upon, and that the process, you know, was fair for everyone.
Because this could cause problems down the road. Could it possibly, if there's, like we heard the call at the beginning, with the person was considering going to a lawyer, but he had already lost his home. His family had already lost that home. Is there a chance that, you know, as that is settled, it could cause title problems down the road, or is it just recourse from the bank?
Well, that's the concern of the real estate and title company industry, that, yes, there are questions about whether the eventual buyers are going to have clear title to the property. If there were flaws in the beginning, that could be subject to challenge.
Okay. Yvonne, you're on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Yes, hi, Ms. Fisher. I have a question as to if the home was put into foreclosure in 2007, but in 2009 you get a letter from the bank that had put your home into foreclosure in 2007 stating that they have bought your mortgage loan. Is that a legal process?
Any idea what Yvonne is going through? I know we don't have the paperwork in front of us, but what kind of scenario might... for our guests here. Go ahead, Linda.
Well, Yvonne's situation sounds like a classic. Nobody knows who actually owned the home for sure when it went into foreclosure, and so that paperwork got shuffled around. I'm assuming that the 2007 foreclosure went all the way to sheriff sale, and that house is either an REO property or maybe it's been resold again. So now in 2009, you get a letter from a lender that thinks they own your paper and isn't even aware that, you know, there was a foreclosure in 2007. It's kind of points out all of the paperwork problems that we've just been talking about.
Yvonne, does that answer your question?
No. Well, this was before the house was sold, that before the house went through the sale or anything, that the letter came stating that that same bank that put it into foreclosure is now the owner of it.
Well, it's probably we can't give legal advice on this show, but again, it just illustrates the complexity of this. Who owns the home? Who should I be talking to try to work this out? And it's not an easy answer in many cases.
That's right, Mike. Yvonne, if you're still living in the home, I'd stay there and see how this sorts out. But, yeah, it's clearly a situation where there's a lot of paper floating around and the left hand does not know what the right hand is doing.
Let's go to a bigger picture call here. Mark, you have a question about the legislation that was passed a couple of years ago. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. As someone who'd formerly run for office in 2004 and had raised the issue of the impending real estate and credit bubble, I've been active on the issue. In 2007, a youth activist group, LaRouche World Youth Movement, had got a couple thousand public officials across the country, township, city, state, and even a few federal people, to endorse what they proposed Homeowners and Bank Protection Act that would have set up an orderly way to sort through the credit problems in both the housing industry and in the banking industry. And then there was a huge backlash on the part of neoconservatives, Democrats, tied in with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and a lot of the global financial speculators who didn't want an orderly reorganization of these two markets. And I guess Barney Frank personally bragged that he squashed that bill, even though there had been thousands of public officials endorsing it. And wondered your thought on the big picture of maybe the global mover and shakers and their stakes in the problem we have here domestically in the United States.
All right, let's get some response here. Linda, familiar with this piece of legislation there was attempted?
Well, I am not personally familiar with the homeowners and Bank Protection Act. I mean, there have been various pieces of legislation introduced on both the federal and state level to try to address or regulate more thoroughly the different pieces of the lending industry. The general response of the lending industry to any suggestion of oversight or regulation is gloom and doom, and if you make us do that, then that will make money less available. It will slow down the lending industry, and there will, none of these things will be happening and that'll be bad for consumers. That's kind of a knee-jerk reaction that I always hear when I'm down at the State House arguing for bills like House Bill 3 and the other foreclosure reform bills that are currently, you know, have died in the Senate. So as to the global picture, I really am not qualified to speculate about
but
that.
But there have been attempts. I know there was a predatory lending bill that was approved, correct me if I'm wrong, as far as the lending side. But now we're looking at the other side, the foreclosure side, and perhaps tightening up those rules and regulations as well.
Well, Senate Bill 185, was the predatory lending bill in Ohio that passed and took effect in January of 2018. A lot of those in 2009. Yeah. And that addresses a lot of problems that came to light about mortgage brokers, and that primarily addresses the regulating mortgage brokers. House Bill 3 proposes to regulate servicers as much as the state is not preempted from doing so by federal law.
Okay. Ron, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just I was listening. I wasn't sure. I was a little off topic, but my house went up for in the foreclosure and was even as far as the sheriff's sale. And I was working with, trying to work with. I had a one of those bad Countrywide loans, and when Bank America took over, and they worked and worked with me, and eventually I was able to save my house and got you know, a decent deal. So I just wanted to let everybody know out there who's struggling with this: if you put in the time on the phone, it can come to fruition.
What exactly did you do, Ron? I don't want to get too much details, but how did you get to talk to the person who could help you? Because that's the complaint, is that you call the 800 number on your bill, and that person oftentimes cannot help you. How did you work through the phone tree?
And that's exactly what you have to do. I would just kept telling them that, you know, I'm interested in saving my house. What do I do? And because you call every time you get a new person, you never get any, you know, continuity in conversation. But, and they have multiple programs that, computer programs that when you make payments and put your, you know, try to work with them, that they, you know, it's a classic, one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing, even though they work at the same place. And it was just a matter of dogged, you know, stick-to-itiveness, saying, you know, I want to save my house. Who do I need to talk to now? Who do I need to talk to now? And, you know, that was my key. It was just the continuation of the phone calls.
But you, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, you had to have the resources to pay the revised or the redone mortgage, correct?
Correct. I was a self-employed artist, and when the economy tanked, art seemed to go by the wayside for a lot of people. And I started driving a cab, and that started paying my bills, and I was able to work through it.
Okay. Well, good for you, Ron.
Yeah, but like I said, my main purpose for calling was because so many people are in my situation that if you do try to work with them, they will work with you. I had a 7.5 interest rate. They knocked it down to 1% for the first couple years, and it goes up 0.5% every couple years. And my payment went from $1,600 to $800.
Wow.
And, you know, they are really working with me, and I just wanted to give everybody else hope.
Okay. Thanks, Ron. Ellen, how common is that story as you work with folks going through this process?
I think it's fairly common. It sounds like Ron had a good attitude about determination to work through that. And I think if the homeowner is able to separate their feelings from the fact that it is a business transaction and they have to get the right information to the right people within the right amount of time, the problem can be resolved.
It can be. It sounds like he was a very patient person.
Yes.
It's pretty frustrating to have to keep explaining your situation call after call after call after call, but that's what you have to do.
Yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh. And the bottom line is he went and drove a cab. See, no matter how many calls you make, if you don't have income, you can't do this, right?
Right. The homeowner has to be creative and really consider all their options and be flexible and open to changing their lifestyle, reducing their expenses, getting a different type of job, accepting any type of job they can, working multiple jobs in order to make ends meet.
Okay. My thanks to Linda Cook from the Ohio Poverty Law Center and Ellen Bardeen from Homes on the Hill. Thanks very much for joining us on All Sides. When we return, we'll get the bank's side of this story with men from the Ohio Mortgage Bankers Association. The past president is up next on All Sides on WOSU.
As a second-generation business owner, new father, and musician at night, keeping informed about the world is necessary and difficult. Whether it's Terry Gross at lunch, Bluegrass Ramble on the weekend, or the BBC at night, WOSU is always on my radio. This is Matthew Sullivan, and WOSU is my source for the information I need to be an informed business owner and father, and the entertainment and music I need to unwind my busy brain.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, our Two of All Sides begins with a conversation with Ohio Casino Control Commissioner Chairperson Charles Roxy Saxby about regulating Ohio's four future casinos to make sure the industry operates with integrity in Ohio. That discussion begins at 11 on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. Creative Futures begin in Saturday morning art classes for children and youth starting in January. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
46 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a slight chance of rain today, otherwise partly sunny and a high of 54. A chance of rain tonight, mainly after midnight, and cloudy skies, a low of 35 degrees. A chance of rain and some light snow Friday morning, and then cloudy skies and a high of 43. All Sides continues on to WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We want to get the bank's perspective on this situation. Of course, we're talking about this latest chapter in the housing crisis, the so-called robo-signing that banks have come under fire for. And joining us is Jeffrey Steed. He is past president of the Ohio Mortgage Bankers Association. He now serves as executive vice president of the Schmidt Mortgage Company in Rocky River, Ohio. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us here on WOSU.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Jeffrey, what is this? Is this poor management, or is it something worse? or is it neither?
Well, it's not something worse. I mean, it is what it is, and it's very difficult to even define it and get your arms around it. If I could, I'd kind of like to start at the beginning of the process, because I think somewhere we touch on the robo-signing issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of misinformation or certainly lack of understanding of really all the steps in the process. And so we need to start by understanding that the foreclosure process differs from state to state and county to county within each state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extremely complex, and there's no doubt that we have a foreclosure problem in this country, a crisis, if you will. When you look just here at Ohio at the 90-odd thousand a year that are going through foreclosure, it's an unprecedented numbers. A not wonderful analogy that I tend to think about in this problem is the airline industry. If you fly commercial airlines, you're accustomed to, you know, your baggage maybe getting there when you get there, and they do a pretty good job. But if the airline suddenly had to take all of the, but in addition to your luggage, they'll also take some freight and some things like that. If suddenly the airline commercial industry had to take over UPS's or FedEx's volume and ship it to, their manpower wouldn't nearly be capable of handling all that, and your luggage probably isn't going to get there. Now, that's not an excuse. It's an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the financial industry, the back-end process, as one of your guests said earlier, you know, has the responsibility, if they're going to make the loan, to handle that backside of it, and she was absolutely correct. But that doesn't happen overnight when you consider the way these numbers have increased dramatically. And then you talk a little bit about the process, which, you know, begins with the fact that just mechanically, you know, when a payment is due, there's a grace period, generally 10, 15 days. After that period of time, the customer is going to be notified. And during that next 45-day period, so many things happen with efforts to contact them through letters, through phone calls, to find out what is causing the delinquency and what needs to be done. And we also have then, if the loan is held by Fannie, Freddie, or FHA, we have the mandated programs of HAMP and HARP and that's more than just programs. It's procedural things. The servicer is required to call or send a letter with a minimum of 4 attempts to contact the borrower. And during that period, they have to determine what is the hardship, retain and obtain financial information, what is their ability to repay, is a modification an option, is there a forbearance program involved. By the time you go through all of that, you're well into 50 days into the process, 60 days. You're 5 months into the process in many instances, and I can elaborate on that. But just to give you an idea of the time frame, mm-hmm. one of the biggest problems lenders are having at that phase is contact with the consumer.
But let's jump to the end. Shouldn't, I mean, the complaint is that these the final straw, yep. the actual, the action that takes the home away,
yep.
Was rushed through.
Yep.
And is that that doesn't seem fair.
I would agree with that. I mean, it doesn't seem fair, and it's probably not fair. I mean, if a lender is not following the procedures and they're not doing it, then it's not right. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. What I'm trying to convey here, though, is that we are talking about a process that may be going on for 6 months mm-hmm. of various people in an organization that are going through trying to work with the borrower and communicate with the borrower and evaluate their options and creating a file and creating a document trail. And now you're going to get to the point where someone, before it actually goes to the foreclosure attorney, in that organization has to sign off and say, yep, we've reviewed this. And what seems to be at the heart of the issue of the robo-signing is that point in time. How, you know, does that person sit there and go through all the file? Do they have affidavits, if it's even required, from every person, every step of the way? Have they reviewed this file that has quite a bit of information before they sign it and say, yep, everything was done? And I think that's the heart of what robo-signing is.
Mm-hmm. But aren't the banks asking at the very beginning, you thought about this process, but one of the things that we keep hearing, and I think it's a justified criticism, is that homeowners weren't always reading the fine print on the documents they signed at closing or the loan agreement they signed, as far as, you know, this is going to, the interest rate's going to increase after 3, 4, 5 years. If you're asking consumers to make sure they read all the documents buying the home, shouldn't the banks have that same responsibility at the end when they're taking the home back?
Absolutely. I'm not going to, I'm not here to defend an improper practice. That wouldn't be my objective at all. Yes.
Is it a case where banks have become too efficient in how they handle mortgages, both on the front end? I mean, they were trying to during the housing boom, handle a lot of mortgages, and there was all these, bundling and rebundling and splitting up and things like that. And a lot of it was relying on automation systems and computer systems. And then here on the back end, now that the boom is over, the banks are using the same processes.
Well, I don't look at it that way. I mean, I certainly know that the media would like to portray it that way. But, again, there's a little bit of perhaps an opportunity for better understanding of it. At the beginning, when the consumer signs it, there's two documents involved, and we sometimes in discussions mix and match. There's the note, mm-hmm. and that says who's owed the money back, who lent the money, and who's owed the money. And there's the mortgage, which says here's our security interest in it. And that note generally is endorsed and sold to someone else. Now, for the majority of the mortgages in this country, it's critical to understand that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and FHA own those mortgages. Now, there's an entire group over the early part of this decade of loans that were made outside of those three entities. And that's almost a different discussion as to what's happened with those. But certainly the millions that are held by those three entities, it's important to understand they own the note. The mortgage, which was recorded, which represents that security interest, is where MERS came into the conversation, which MERS is the equivalent, if I could say, of the book entry system with your stocks on the stock exchange.
It stands for Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems.
Correct. You know, in the old days, if somebody bought a stock, they actually got the stock certificate from that company. Well, that hasn't happened in decades. MERS is the similar scenario, which is the physical mortgage was recorded in the county where that property resided, and MERS became the electronic recording system to track that mortgage and the note holder, which was still a separate document. And it is the equivalent of the book entry system for stocks. And it is important to know that that's not secret information. Any government entity for free can log on to MERS with an ID number and find out who the servicer is, if the property is vacant, who the entity is that's responsible for that. It's not a private closed system. You could go to the MERS website and if you're a government for free, become essentially a member and have access to all of that information. Earlier in the show, I heard a comment that MERS perhaps was diverting potential income from county recorders. But the other side of that is when that mortgage is initially recorded back in the paper environment before MERS, if you look at the volume of mortgages recorded through not only sales but refinances over the last several decades, what is not widely appreciated is how overwhelmed county recorder offices were. In some counties here in Ohio, it was taking 6 months or more to get that recorded document back. You couldn't do anything with that other than keep filing assignments that were still 6 months in arrears to even get recorded and tracked.
Jeffrey Steed is the past president of the Ohio Mortgages Bankers Association. He joins us here on All Sides on WOSU. Jeffrey, have we just overwhelmed the system with the number of mortgages that have been out there and then the refinancing? I mean, it just seems like the reason why you have people signing quickly is they don't have enough people to review the documents.
Well, you're touching on a critical issue. Have we overwhelmed the system? Yes, we have overwhelmed the system with defaults. Let's face it, we're not talking about people that are filing foreclosures on people that have paid their bills and it's current. We are overwhelming the system with defaults. That's what we are all dealing with.
But shouldn't the banks be? Shouldn't the banks be responsible if you make the loan to handle the back end as well?
Absolutely, and I don't disagree with that for one moment. Absolutely, but you cannot gear that up overnight. And it's mm-hmm. been years now that we are trying to direct in many across the country, and the massive servicers in particular, and many institutions that, you know, are servicing hundreds of thousands of mortgages. It takes a while to get the resources allocated to that area, which never had to deal with these volumes. And I'm not defending them, but it is a fact that you can't just simply shift that amount of increased activity and requirements, plus the legislation that keeps coming, instructing them what steps they have to take, these reviews, these HAMP programs, all of which are critical to try and keep the person in the house, because the reality is nobody wants that. The bank doesn't want the foreclosure. The homeowner doesn't want the foreclosure. Nobody wants it.
Well, let me get to that, because that has been a criticism that it is easier in some cases and more financially prudent and better for the bottom line if the bank just quickly moves on the foreclosure rather than trying to work with the homeowner to work out a payment plan.
Well, there is merit to the argument that says if the homeowner cannot recover, bring the mortgage current, or afford it, then it is in everybody's best interest to move forward quickly. There's no argument with that in theory.
I guess the argument is, are banks doing enough to determine that?
I don't know if enough is ever enough. I mean, we have a problem in this country from the homeowner's perspective and the lender's. Mm-hmm. When you look at these numbers of, you know, we're roughly 90,000 in Ohio per year alone, are they doing enough? I don't know. But I will tell you that there are certainly many instances where the borrower has no means to make that payment. And you need to move along. But you've got to go back to that time frame and the steps that have to be taken in terms of evaluating their financial condition. You know, people say, well, I'm getting unemployment because I lost my job. And that's, in here in Ohio, we've certainly heard ad nauseum the last 2 months how many jobs we've lost in Ohio. Well, they have unemployment. Well, unfortunately, when you're looking at Fannie and Freddie and FHA and those programs and trying to do a modification or a forbearance or something, they don't. That's not permanent income. It doesn't qualify. It might help them get through, but it's not a permanent solution to the program. I would like to interject at that this point also. It is very, very important that homeowners in Ohio and anyone listening that has an issue be aware of the Ohio Housing Finance Agency's $500 million that they have available under their hardest hit fund, which is just announced on September 27th. And I'd like to give two websites and a phone
number.
Yes,
please.
Under the website, www.savethedream.ohio.gov, or by calling 1-888-404-4674. Anyone that's in the process or in a position right now where they're unable to make their mortgage payments and they're falling behind, they need to contact that website or that phone number and contact OFA, as we call it, and determine. There are four different programs available that can help make the mortgage, ranging from helping make the mortgage payment until they get back on their feet or their income stabilized, perhaps even paying down part of the mortgage, but working with the servicer and trying to preserve that home.
Well, one last question, Mr. Steve, before we let you go. Is robocalls, robo-signing, is that process dead now after all this?
Well, there is no responsible financial institution in the country that isn't addressing it, I'll tell you that.
Okay.
And yeah, I guarantee you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jeffrey Steed. He's past president of the Ohio Mortgage Bankers Association. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides on WOSU.
Thanks
I'm Mike
for
Thompson.
Having me, Mike.
Thanks.